It's such an honor, Danny, to be part of this amazing podcast you're doing here, and it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
Your podcast is the one that I listen to when I want to listen to an interviewer who has A, actually read the book she's asking questions about, and B, asks really interesting, insightful questions about it, and I think that's really special.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
It was a good chat, great chat. You're a good interviewer.
It's an absolute pleasure to be interviewed by a very articulate person such as yourself.
I've so enjoyed listening to the podcast. Truly, I love it. And it does just feel like you're having a chat with your mate.
That's brilliant what you do. Honestly, I'm so in awe, and we need more word nerds like yourself.
Today, I have the pleasure of chatting with Tabitha Bird about her beautiful book, A Lifetime of Impossible Days, a thoughtful, uplifting and magical story of childhood, family and finding ways to change the inevitable. Meet Willa Waters, aged 8, 33 and 93. Can the three Willas come together to heal their past and save their future? Tabitha Bird's stunning debut is a magical, life-affirming novel about heartbreak, healing and learning to forgive yourself. I'm your host, Danny V. Welcome to the Words and Nerds podcast, Tabitha. It's great to be talking about this incredibly wondrous book, A Lifetime of Impossible Days.
Thank you, Danny. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to talk about it.
Now, for those who haven't read the novel, can you give us a 10 or 20 second elevator pitch as to what the book is about?
Yeah, for sure. So the book is about the three Willas, but the middle character, middle Willa, she's 33 years old, Willa Waters, and she's 33 years old, and she meets herself at ages 8 and aged 93 through a time slip that is planted in her backyard. And the three Willas, that's why I call them the three Willas, because there's the three of them at three different ages, they have to work together to save their future and heal their past.
And it was just such an interesting concept. And I want to know, how did this idea first emerge? Because I imagine when it first emerged, it might have been a bit messy.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, I never actually set out to write a book. And the Willas were never in my head. So I actually just sort of started out 11 years ago wanting to heal some of my own trauma. And the way in which I started doing that was to write. And I actually started writing about a little girl character and another character called Beast, who was my pain. And that sort of just flowed out of me. And probably 3 or 4 years later, I had an 150,000 word, very messy memoir, and decided through some twists and turns of events that memoir wasn't what I wanted to do. And it wasn't sort of until I looked at what I love reading that I came up with the idea of fiction, obviously, and then fiction with that otherworldly twist. So this is contemporary fiction with what is known as magical realism. So fiction set in the world in which we live in, but just that otherworldly twist. And so for the Willas, it's that sort of magical element of being able to meet themselves at an older and younger age. And the Willas sort of came to me when I realized that I would love to have gone back and loved that little girl that I was. I wished that I could do that. And then also the desire to have an older self sort of standing on the sidelines with pom-poms, cheering me on, going, you know, hold on, it does get better, keep going. And when I kind of put those ideas together in my head, the Willas started to talk to me, as it were.
It's amazing.
Three Willas.
And what a lovely thought that you've got yourselves beside you, guiding you through life. I think that's what we need. They'll always be right on your team, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think, well, for me, Silver Willa was that character who sort of had so carried a lot of the wisdom in the book, or she did for me anyway, even though she's a little muddled in her older years. She says a lot of things which make a lot of sense if you really think about where she's coming from and what she's saying. And I really believed that she was in there sort of saying, you know, look, don't give up, there's hope, and I know that this is going to get better, and I know that I know that you've got strength and I know that you can pull through. And even when I was writing her, I could feel that. And I hoped that she communicated, well, I wanted her to communicate that to the other characters, but she communicated it to me too while I was writing it. So yeah, it was fun. She was a fun character to write. She's probably my favorite.
Yeah, she made me laugh out loud too, just some of the things she would say and the wisdom behind it. No one would understand her and how frustrating that would be, but she always had that humor. I think Grammy, she was a beautiful character as well.
Yeah, thank you. I loved Grammy. She's a little bit based on my own grandmother, just bibs and bobs in there I borrowed from my grandmother. For example, my grandmother loves to feed possums. I'm probably sure she shouldn't be doing that, but nobody's going to tell an 82-year-old woman like my grandmother what she should or shouldn't be doing. So she goes right ahead and feeds the possums. So I sort of popped little details like that into the book, and definitely the great love and just that big-hearted welcome arms that Grammy is for Supercon Boots Willa and even Middle Willa is definitely my own grandmother. So the heart of Grammy is my own grandmother, even though my grandmother wouldn't bake or sew if you paid her.
I was about to ask about the jam drops.
No, that's not my grandmother at all. Actually, as I was writing the book, I realized that I would get to certain places and need a break, and often I would bake, and it was a way to sort of get my boys involved. I've got three boys, so they are always looking for something to eat. And so being able to bake something fairly simple like jam drops, where you've got most of the ingredients in the house already, is always appealing. And so I would find myself baking them. And throughout the book, throughout the edits, throughout writing it, I'd bake these jam drops. And so sort of late in the drafts, I thought, you know what, I think I'll give this jam drop baking thing that I do to the Willers, because it's quite soothing and something that Grammy can do with the little one, sort of when they need that comfort and that activity that's done side by side together. And baking is just that warm, lovely activity that I thought would be good for the Willers to partake in, especially that little one. She needs a lot of that.
Absolutely. And it's so funny that you say that wasn't brought into the end, because it was such an important, it was an important motif throughout the novel, like you said, of comfort or never eating them alone. And I thought that was a really nice idea.
Yeah, it's interesting, I think, what pops itself into as books grow. I'm quite a messy writer. I don't work from plans. I would love to be that writer who had all her chapters beautifully outlined, and I'm in awe of writers that do that, and I really tried very hard to be like them, and it just didn't work. And in the end, I gave up and thought, you know what, I am the writer that I am. My voice comes the way it comes, and the story grows the way it grows, and I stopped fighting with myself and just let the story grow and develop, and it ended up being all the better for it. And jam drops was certainly an example of that. Interestingly enough, the ocean, which is pretty integral to the whole whole story, was one of the very last details to be added as well. So, wow. Yeah, I had an agent say to me, "So Tab, how do the Willers actually meet?" And I said, "Well, it's magic. They just meet, you know, just go with it." And she said, "No, I need to know how they get together, that your readers need more than just it's magic. They need to know how they're actually meeting." And it never had occurred to me that I needed something specific to show how they were meeting. I just had them meet in scenes and the scenes just play it out. And she said, "You know, you're writing time travel." I said, "I'm not writing time travel." She said, "Oh, yes, you are." She said, "You've got older and younger and they're meeting in their different time zones. That's time travel." I thought, "Oh, yeah." Wow, okay, yes. And so I needed something that, you know, could link them. And something I wanted to write something different, something I hadn't seen before. I'd seen, you know, obviously we've got Narnia with the closet and there's, you know, doors through to other portholes and et cetera, et cetera. I wanted to have something that was really, really different, that they could meet each other, something I hadn't heard of before. So the ocean seemed to fit the bill.
Absolutely, especially because water can symbolise so many things, you know, the cleansing of oneself or baptism. So that really works, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Interesting. I didn't even think about the ocean on any of those deep levels, and I've had so many great conversations with readers since the book's come out about why I chose the ocean and how wonderful it is, and it works on so many different you know, levels, on soul levels and all the rest of it. And I always ooh and ah over their comments and think, yeah, I never thought of that. To me, the ocean just popped into my head as being the most unlikely thing that could front up in Boona, being that we're dry as a bone out here most of the times. And something also that was not able to be put in a box and definitely wouldn't fit inside a jam jar. And that's why I was taken with the idea, and then my imagination just run amok after that point. But yeah, and then people were like, you know, it's that calming effect when you go to the ocean, and it's that. And I was like, yeah, this is all wonderful, but I, you know, you're I did not think about it on that depth until after it was actually written. So yeah, it totally does work on lots of them.
That's really
and I wish I had have known that when I thought about it.
Sometimes as a reader too, you make these connections yourself, you know. They may not have been intentional, but you know, as a reader, you're coming from a different place,
and I think that's great. And I love connections readers make with both the Willers and the ocean and all the rest of it. It's always really interesting, and I always think, gosh, they're so much smarter than I am, these readers. they've thought this through on so much of a deeper level.
Or you just but go, yes, of course I meant that.
Yeah, I think perhaps it was, I mean, obviously it was in me, and that, you know, it came out, but yeah, it was obviously there in some deep layers, but not in my conscious when I was putting it in.
And going back to childhood trauma, I thought it was just such a lovely thought that we can heal ourselves. And it wasn't long ago that I spoke to Corey White about his memoir, The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory, about childhood trauma. And he also said an interesting thing. I mean, he obviously didn't have the benefit of magical realism.
Yes.
But he spoke to that inner voice, you know, that inner childhood voice. And as I was reading this, because I just read his memoir, I thought, wow, it is a really important message to go back and love that child you were and tell that child it wasn't their fault and forgive and heal so you can do that as an adult. And I just saw so many parallels to, you know, what we need to do as adults.
Yeah, I completely agree. And definitely in my own healing journey, that was a large part of it. And I think sometimes as adults, you know, we are just so busy, you know, we grow up, we might get married, we might have children, and life just, for me in any case, got very busy, and I threw myself into all manner of responsible things, but never let myself actually stop and grieve and actually deal with the past until the past just caught up with me and there was no way to, you know, to push it down or to push it away anymore. And, you know, I don't think we often just sit back and go, you know, are there perhaps some parts of me that have things they might want to tell me? Are there some undealt with, you know, traumas or even just some things that my younger self might want to say, like, you know, you don't have a lot of fun anymore, maybe, or have you forgotten all the things that you might have wanted to do, or this great fun activity that you used to enjoy that you haven't made time for in about 20 years? You know, just little things can be actually really big things. So I was scared to ask my younger self what she might want to say, because I anticipated that most of it would be fairly traumatic. And some of it definitely was, but it was interesting that a lot of it wasn't. And there were things simply like, you know, do you remember that you like to draw? Have you forgotten that you like to tell story? You used to play, you have a big imagination. It was things like this. And I was shocked. I was like, oh yeah, I'd completely forgotten that. So it's interesting that when we repress trauma, we're not just repressing bad things, but we're also repressing all those wonderful parts of ourselves as well and forgetting those too. So part of my journey was definitely going back and asking that little girl, what did she have to say and what did she need and what did she want now, and other really interesting questions that changed the course of my adult life. I mean, I got a book out of it.
And I do. I found that part really sad, you know, being sort of middle Willers age range. You know, I thought the 8-year-old and the 93-year-old are just saying whatever they want to say. They're not afraid. They still imagine things are possible and they still believe. But when you're in that middle stage and you have the past behind you and the future in front of you and you're wrangling children, it's easy to get lost, isn't it?
It is. It really is easy to get lost. And I don't know if it's maybe more so for women, because we are so caught up perhaps with kids and other things, and culture does tell us that, you know, we should put everyone else first, even though I don't actually believe in that rhetoric. But, you know, that is sort of the messages that we get sent from culture, is that, you know, we're last, kids are first, everything we want comes second, everybody else comes first, we should look after everyone else. And certainly that was the many of the lies that I was believing. And there's not that time just to stop and just go, hang on a second, I'm actually not doing very okay right now, or I need some help, or I'm afraid of this, or I want this, or so many other things that might pop up for us. So, yeah, I totally agree. We do get really caught in those middle years sometimes, or we can get.
Absolutely. And that's what I drew from, because I thought, you know, this is really indicative of the 2019 woman, you know, and it's really interesting to look back and look forward and try and take some elements of that childhood or of that 90-year-old who doesn't care anymore about what anyone's saying about them. I think that's fabulous.
I absolutely agree. It's funny, my husband said to me after he read the book, he said, "Are you planning on becoming Silver Willa?" And I said, "You better believe it. I
lock that in."
I hope that I increasingly step into my own voice and you know, I don't want to be rude to people, obviously, but just want to say things that are true for me and not be so concerned all the time about, you know, what everyone else is thinking and doing, and live my own large and wonderful life, you know, so which Silver Willa does.
And who wouldn't want to be Silver Willa when you're 93, honestly?
Absolutely.
Now, the novel also goes into some pretty dark territory, and we've touched on it with childhood trauma, but it, you know, it explores domestic violence and sexual abuse and then the impact on other families, and then even later on, the manipulation of the abusers and how they shape what happened. And it was just a really complex issue in the book. And I was just wondering, for you, why was that so important for you to explore in this book?
Yeah, it was really important for me to explore for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I suppose I wanted to put my own emotional truth into this book. So although it's a fictional story with, you know, fictional characters and fictional events, I like to say that it's emotionally true. The things that I learnt while I was healing from my own story have definitely gone into the Willa's story. So it was important for me on that level that I wanted a place where I could explore that for my own reasons. And then secondly, on another level, I wanted to be able to show what it looks like for someone that's healing from trauma, how messy that process is, how much back and forth is involved in that, and how very intelligent, very strong women can still be very impacted by lies that they've been told when they were younger, and that they're not even challenging them as lies because they believe them to be true. And just the power that abusers can have over us in terms of sitting on our voice, and just changing really the way in which we think and the way in which we see the world and the way in which we see ourselves. And it was important for me to show that so that, you know, anyone else out there who's dealt with that could perhaps see themselves in that and perhaps see the hope of healing out of that. But even anyone who has not dealt with that might have more insight or greater compassion or greater awareness of just what that looks like and how powerful that hold is for many women when they've come from trauma and abuse, and just how hard it is to shake and how hard it is to confront those lies. Because if you don't even see them as lies, it's difficult to confront them, you know. And you know, Middle Willa in the book has helped with a very gifted counsellor, and I myself had a lot of help from a very gifted counsellor. But you really do need a second set of eyes to start showing some light and suggesting that there might be other ways to perhaps see events that have happened in the past. And I found it quite shocking when my counsellor would suggest to me very basic things like, you know, have you considered that perhaps you weren't to blame as a child? You know, that was revolutionary to me. Mm-hmm. And yet for somebody who hasn't gone through it, they might think, well, of course you're not, you know, no children are to blame. But if you haven't lived it, then you don't understand how powerful those early messages that we get are in shaping the way in which we see the world. And so it was just important for me to show that and explore some of those issues and then, you know, give invitations for readers perhaps to, you know, take that on wherever that may lead them, whatever that may look like for them.
It was very interesting, that aspect of the novel, and I really liked how Super Gumboots Willa, she reclaimed being a girl and then later on Middle Willa being a woman and reclaiming that power. You know, you're not just powerful if you're a man, you can also be powerful as a woman and a girl too, and I liked that idea.
Yeah, I loved it too. I mean, unfortunately, I wasn't able to claim that when I was a child because there wasn't really anyone around who could do that for me. So it was kind of a desire, I guess, to go back now as a woman and do that for my younger self and to show her that, you know, being a little girl is just as great as being a little boy, because being a woman is just as wonderful as being a man. And some of the things that Middle Willa tells Super Gumboots Willa were, in fact, things I really was telling myself. So, but yeah, it is really powerful, I think, to have some of those conversations. And I think magical realism in this book was such a wonderful tool for me, because it gave me the ability to have the past be an actual character, so that Middle Willa could talk to the past, and it made the future an actual character, and so we can see Middle Willa talking to the future. And I often even just invite people, as they ask me these questions, to just say, you know, make up characters of your past and your future, because it's far easier to have conversation with an actual being than it is some highfalutin past or highfalutin, you know, future. And you get actual answers that you're surprised about. And certainly these characters taught me a great deal.
That's very interesting. I also really liked Sam, and I thought it was so important to have that kind of character juxtaposed against, obviously, the toxic masculinity and power of the father.
Yeah. And I am pretty blessed to have a Sam in my life. my husband has been in my life for some 28 years. I'm losing count now. And we've been married for 22 of those years. And we are incredibly blessed to have met each other when we were 16 and 17. And I really don't know how that happened, to be completely honest. every boyfriend before my husband had been abusive in one way, shape or form. And he was the first, you know, man that I met who was not. And if you look at statistics, women, young girls who've come from abusive homes tend to marry abusive men because that's what's normal for them, and they follow in those patterns. So statistically, I should have married an abusive man. However, I didn't, and I was gifted with this amazing boy who then turned into this amazing man who has been beside me through all of that healing. And I think he was the reason that I began to believe that there could be goodness in the opposite sex, because I thought, well, they can't all be bad because I've married one. But for many, many, many years there, I believed there was only one good man on the face of this earth, and I was married to him.
Lucky you.
Yeah. And it wasn't until I had, you know, little boys of my own that I thought, well, then there must be a couple more. And then I was challenged by the notion that perhaps that was a story that was in my head because of the trauma I'd experienced, and perhaps there were many good men out there and I just needed to open my eyes to see them. And I have since been blessed to meet many other very good men. But, yes, Sam was needed in the book very much.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when you have a son of your own, you realise that then you need to create more good men in the world. Yes.
You do. And I think, you know, when my, you know, little ones were little ones, you know, I just saw them as children. And so I didn't see them as potential men, even though, of course, that's what they were going to grow up to be. And really the most challenging time for me as they came into their teen years, which they're in now, my eldest being 16 and my middle one is 12, so almost 13. And just realizing that, in fact, they are growing to be men, and realizing that, you know, what does that mean, and have I done a good job of raising them to be the kind of men in this world that I think the world needs more of?
It's a big responsibility.
It is. It's huge, especially when you have come from my past. You know, it is a big responsibility. So, I mean, I know that all mothers want to raise great. Well, I hope that all mothers want to raise great young men. But I felt the weight, the burden of that profoundly on my shoulders.
I imagine.
And a good job, yeah.
And I think because toxic masculinity is such an issue, you know, in our society now, I think that, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, parents, hopefully not just mothers, who are really trying their best to, you know, create those sensitive boys who can talk about their feelings and, you know, don't draw on that toxic masculinity. That's the hope anyway.
It is. It really is. I think even, you know, my husband and I have had to watch that we probably don't overreact to some of their childish behaviour, because not all of it is, you know, that toxic boyhoodness. It, you know, most of what they, you know, do, whether it was tantrums when they were younger or whether it was just, you know, losing their cool on a bad afternoon after school or whatever, is just boyish childishness that needs to just be retrained and, you know, here's a better way of dealing with your emotions. But my husband and I have tended to just jump all over not having any of that nonsense in our house, and then have had to sort of pull back and go, okay, that was a very overly emotion reaction to what is really just a regular teen problem. And my boys have sometimes gone, okay, Mum, I'm not going to turn out to be someone who yells at women and hits women. I'm just having a moment, you know. Like, okay.
As a parent, though, it's terrifying, isn't it?
It is. It really is. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, my son's only 7 and I'm still, you know, all over that too. And sometimes
I look at my 12-year-old and he's really tall and really quite a solid young man already. I mean, I'm 5'7". He's already close on 5'7" at the age of 12. He's much broader than me. I can already see all his muscles developing. I know he's going to grow very tall and be physically a man that you might look at, and if you're walking down the street, go, ooh, you know, is he safe? Is he not safe? And so I'm always on him about, you know, you need to always be in control of your body, you know. And it's just, I wonder, I often sometimes check myself and go, just remember that, you know, my trauma doesn't need to inform all my parenting. You know what I mean? He's a child.
But it's a good message to have, isn't it? That everyone is always responsible for their own, you know, body and actions. I think we do need to keep reminding people of that, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. I agree.
And there was something in the book that I found just really, you know, profound and spoke to me, was that, you know, we talk about death and, as Grammy did, she talked about, you know, going into death, and that's just a part of life and it's another story, but we never know how to be left behind. And I just thought that was just so, it was so true, you know, because we're very bad at that, I think.
We really are. We're afraid of talking about it, you know. We're afraid of what it looks like and what it sounds like and what it feels like. And even death is not something that, you know, majority of culture is all that comfortable with talking about. And I have been blessed with a couple of beautiful, wise women in my life who talk about it like Grammy does, as it being just another chapter, and, you know, and are very open with how they want, you know, their final days on this earth to be and what they want their funerals to look like, and also just their wishes for those who are left behind. And I think it's such a great and almost healing way in which to speak about death, you know, that we can enjoy exiting this world. You know, we get 80 whatever years on this planet, that, you know, we should, you know, be able to exit the way we would like as much as is possible, and talk to those around us about that, and not, you know, try not to be so uncomfortable about it. It's not, I mean, obviously no one wants to think of their loved ones dying, but I'd rather know what they want and, you know, then have them pass and not know. But yes, it was very important for me, for Grammy, to chat about that.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting and very indicative of our society and how we deal with loss. Not very well.
No, we don't. We don't deal with a number of uncomfortable topics very well.
That's why I like to talk about them on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about them too.
And of course the book is about storytelling and how important stories are for your imagination, for healing, for comfort, for family. And it was just such a lovely thread throughout the novel.
Absolutely. I think stories when I was younger definitely saved me. I learnt to read as soon as I could, and then after that realized that I could, you know, make up my own adventures and would tell them to my dog and to my sister. And it's definitely the way in which I coped with my childhood. And the reason that I believe I didn't have a complete psychotic break in my teen years was because I had story and I had books. So sort of somewhere else to go, if you like. So a socially acceptable way of splitting off, I suppose. And then, you know, that I had the gift of writing when I needed it, to explore some of those emotions and help my counsellor to understand what was going on inside my head as well. So such a gift. Words are such a gift.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Mm.
Now, besides the recipe of jam drops, which I was just looking at, I think I might give that a crack, actually.
Yeah.
Very simple. I could probably just find the ingredients in the cupboard.
It is. Very I like simple. That.
How could you not feel like a jam drop after reading this novel?
Absolutely.
But besides that, when I flip over, there is just this glorious picture.
Yes.
of you, gumboots, typewriter, tea, books, yes, photo frames, and it is just the most glorious picture I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you. Yes, my chihuahua's in there too, I believe, sitting on the lap.
And it's exactly how I pictured Middle Willa.
Oh, thank you. Well, yes, there must be chihuahuas. And when we were taking the photos, the photographer, he is a professional photographer, he's also a personal friend, he said to me, I think you should gather up all of the things that have been important to you while you were writing the book, bring them on out to one of the fields in Boona and we'll do the photo shoot out there. So we had a lot of fun putting those photos together.
Oh, I love it. I turned it over and went, oh, this is beautiful. So I think when you read the book, you need to go to that first so yeah, you can imagine Middle Willa as you read it and the little dog,
yeah,
frog dog.
Yeah. Well, that's actually Lion. So,
oh, that's Lion, of
yeah,
course.
Lion, yeah, is a real-life chihuahua. She's my baby. I got her 11 years ago when I was actually struggling and my husband wanted to find a way to show me that he loved me, and one of the things he did was give me that little dog. So she's been beside me, and she was there for every word of writing that book, and she's actually beside me right now as I speak too.
Oh,
so
hello, Lion. You've been very quiet, Lion.
She's a very good girl as long as I'm here.
So what is next for you? Have you got another book in the pipelines? You didn't even know you were going to write this one.
I know, yeah, it's quite a shock that we have a book in hands. Yes, there is. So whilst I was waiting for that book to be picked up by an agent, I did the thing that they tell all writers to do, which is to write the next book. So I did. It was a very messy draft and I wrote it and put it to the side and then, of course, got the contract with A Lifetime of Impossible Days and threw my heart and soul into finishing that and bringing that to publication. But just recently have found some new ways in which I'm going to revamp it and it will be the next story. So its working title is The Emporium of Imaginary or The Emporium of Imagination. Not sure which way I'm going to go with that yet. And it's the same genre, so contemporary fiction, but magical realism, so with that otherworldly twist in it. So
wonderful. I haven't read much magical realism. I have here and there, but I think I'm just become such a great fan now.
Oh, that's wonderful. I find it often hard to track down. It's because it's often tucked away in contemporary fiction or it's tucked away in other sort of, we don't have, you know, on the bookshelves, you don't walk into a bookstore and there's not, you know, the magical realism shelf.
Yeah, that's right.
So it can sometimes be hard to find them. So, yes. But I love them as well.
Well, what a delightful novel, full of imagination and hope, as well as dealing with those uglier side of humanity. But so, such a delight to read. I've got to tell you a funny story. I was finishing the book in the bath, but I dropped the book in the bath.
Oh, no.
And so my book is, look, I did finish it, obviously, but it looks very loved and a bit crumpled. But, it's time to get out of the bath. Just went slipped right through my fingers.
Well, it looks like it's gone through the ocean there.
It does, absolutely. It really looks like it's been under that mango tree. So it's funny, I was going to lend it to a colleague who loves magic realism. I thought,
maybe not.
I don't know if she liked my bathwater book, but I'll offer it to her anyway.
Oh, I love it when I see readers bring their copies to events to sign and they're like, oh, I'm so sorry, it's been written in and I've dog-eared the pages, but I just loved it. I'm like, no, that's a well-loved book. I love seeing a well-loved book.
Exactly. And it does look well-loved. And also really clean, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
But I loved the hope of this book and that we can change and we can listen and, most importantly, we can forgive ourselves. So I really enjoyed that part. So thank you so much for bringing it into the world.
Oh, thank you, Danny. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's important for me to let people know that we're not the sum of our pasts. Whatever's happened to us, we can take it and we get to rewrite the story. We get to rewrite the story where we're at, and then we get to write the ending.
So I think that's such a great message. And thank you again for chatting with me.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me, Danny. It's a pleasure.